Okay, good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Thursday, January 19th, 2012 meeting of the Zone 3 Advisory Committee. And call the meeting to order. Could we have a roll call?
Sure. Member Molnar.
Here.
Member Gehring.
Here.
Member Vardis.
Here.
Member Lucy.
Here.
Member Akita.
Here.
And Chairman Costello.
Here. Okay, we have a quorum. At this point, we're going to open the floor for public comment. This is an opportunity for anyone in the audience, the public, to address the committee on items not in the agenda. Is there anyone interested in speaking tonight? Seeing no one, we'll close that and come to item three. This is minutes for the meeting of November 17th, 2011. I'll ask if any members have questions, comments, changes.
I got a minor correction on page 3, 6B. If you look down through that paragraph, you'll see that we endorsed Mr. Talley and Mr. Ikeda. And what it says is Mr. Talley and Mr. Vardis.
Got the Vard and the Vardis mixed up there. That's what happened.
Understandable. Thank you, Jim. Any other changes? Then I'll entertain a motion.
I move to approve the minutes.
A second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll have a vote. Can we do a voice vote on this one?
Sure.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. Brings us to point four, the operations report. A is the water plant operations.
Mr. Coleman will be presenting this item.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Ron Coleman, superintendent for South County Operations, and I'll give the operations report. We'll start with the Lopez Lake. Everybody hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Lopez Lake elevation today was 515.63, storage of 43,235 acre feet, and that's 87.8% capacity. Rainfall to date 4.52 inches, and the current downstream releases are 3.3 million gallons a day. The water treatment plant treatment processes are performing well. Plant production is 5 MGD. State water's 0.6 million gallons a day. All five racks are functioning well. End run turbidities are 0.02, so the plant's running quite well. Any questions on that so far?
Looks like there aren't any.
I wanted to make two points from the last meeting. There was a question about a report on the August 13th plant shutdown, and a draft summary report has been turned in and will be presented to the TAC, to the Zone 3 TAC staff, and for their review and input. That's the next step. And then John Wallace asked about, is John here? John Wallace asked about the year-to-date on the Zone 3 monthly report, if it could be clarified a little bit. And so you'll notice that the year-to-date now, because there's three different categories, so the year-to-date for Lopez deliveries is now April to present, which is the water year. The year-to-date for state water is January to present, which is the calendar year. So try to clarify that a little bit. That's it.
Very good.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes, go right ahead.
Excuse my frog, my throat, but the releases, the scheduled releases, are they staying on schedule? Are we still doing the releases? Are you the right person to ask this question?
Well, no, our releases were actually a little bit lower than what we had been in the past. It's 4.0 MGD. We're a little bit lower now, so we're a little bit ahead of the game.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ron, for the report. I appreciate that. Brings us to item five tonight, budget.
Hi,
Wasn't expecting that was kind of quick. There's two items. I have the budget status report and the 12-13 budget. So first I'd like to start with the second quarter budget status. Please refer to the handouts in your, the graphs in your handouts. There's three graphs reflecting the second quarter versus actual second quarter budget versus actual. The first graph represents the routine operations and maintenance. As of the second quarter, we're under budget by about 9%, or $148,000. The majority of the savings comes from the water treatment plant's professional services section. And the second graph represents the non-routine O&M. These costs are under budget by 43% or $53,000. Much of the savings comes from the Lopez Water Rights HCP. And some of those expenditures you'll see in the third or fourth quarter of this fiscal year. Same thing with the third quarter, the third graph for capital outlay. We're under budget by 62% or $415,000. This again is due to the water line crossing Rodriguez Bridge. This project is underway and expenses will be reflected in the next two quarters as well. So overall, Zone 3, we're under budget by 25% in the second quarter. So we've been pretty consistent with being under. And there's no questions? Any questions on the second quarter?
I've got one quick question.
Okay.
I think you may have mentioned something, but are we projecting that, although we're under significantly now, that those are going to catch up with us as the year progresses?
I'd say for routine O&M, yes. Non-routine O&M and the capital outlay, based on conversations with staff.
Okay, thank you. Uh-huh. Any other questions?
No.
Okay.
The second item is the fiscal year budget for 12-13. I'll be handing out the 12-13 budget books and also be mailing them to the finance directors and TAC members. So as a reminder, our process for Zone 3 is we distribute the books today for your review, and you will meet. We'll meet with the TAC members and the Finance Committee sometime in February, and hopefully you'll have a chance to discuss with them any concerns or any questions you have so that when we meet, they can be addressed at that time. And so we'll meet again, I guess, on March 15th, Thursday, and hopefully at that point the budget will be endorsed by the advisory committee. Once that happens, then in June it'll go to the board for board of supervisors for adoption of the budget. So in a brief summary, operation and maintenance has increased by less than 1%. Non-routine decreased by 10.46%. So total billings overall, the decrease has been 1.44%. And the budget this last year, 11-12 versus the new, the 12-13 budget, is about $97,000 less. And we submitted in July 2010 a five-year billing estimates to your finance committee, and so compared that to what we've actually budgeted, we're about $590,000 less. So I'm going to go ahead and hand these out to you. I've also included a timeline in there, and it just kind of breaks down what to expect.
Thank you.
So if you have any questions, I know you haven't had a chance to review it, but I've tried to make it as colorful and clear as possible and big. So hopefully, I know there were some concerns the last couple of years that they were too small. And so if there's any questions or...
It does look easier to read this year.
Good.
It's a big plus, so...
Jenny, we expect the budget to come back to the Zone 3 Advisory Committee in March 15th.
March 15th, our next Advisory Committee. I'm meeting with, or I'll be at the TAC meeting, I believe, on the 2nd of February and discuss the budget then with them, and then schedule finance meeting probably mid-February. It's usually been historically when we've done that. So by... If there's any questions, and if there are any questions that you have before March 15th or even in the next week or so, feel free to call me or email me.
Your contact's in here, right?
Excuse me?
Is your contact info in here?
No, it's not. I'm sorry.
Our next step then with Santa Margarita is to conduct the Prop 218 vote, the assessment. We haven't set the exact timing on that yet. Essentially, Santa Margarita's cost of developing a drought reliability program is going to run about $5 a month. Its options include working solely with the county and the county state water allocation through the ops center. With Zone 3 under some of the general policy direction, in which case, if that option is pursued, we'd be back in front of your advisory committee with details, or even potentially with any other number of state water contractors. So it's really going to be a while before any more details are developed with Santa Margarita, because the next step is conducting a Prop 218 vote to see whether or not the property owners want to proceed with it and are willing to pay the $5 a month. If that ends up being the case, then we'll go through the deliberative process of the various options and get into the details of those, including the possible Zone 3 option. And then if the Zone 3 option is the one that becomes the preferred alternative for Santa Margarita, then we'd be back and with the advisory committee discussing details and everything. But I wouldn't anticipate that. At the earliest, probably about 6 months.
Do we have any idea of when that Prop 218 vote might be if they decide to go forward? November?
No. It will be, since the Prop 218 vote isn't, it's a vote of the write-in vote of the property owners. The steps are basically getting the draft assessment engineers board on the board's agenda and then conducting the process, which is a minimum 45-day process. So at the earliest, I would anticipate we would be with the Board of Supervisors in March, which then would have a conclusion of it in around May. But I'd say in front of the Board of Supervisors, probably realistically March, April timeframe, and then know, you know, whether the vote in Margarita was up or down in the May, June timetable.
Very good. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
And then on the emergency releases for storm flow mitigation, that, you know, update is that, you know, obviously we haven't had a lot of rain, so there hasn't been a lot of work. But the commitment to the advisory committee last time, which is to go back to the technical advisory committee and work through the types of analysis that might be appropriate in making decisions on pre-storm releases. Some of that basic analysis has been done. My understanding is that, again, we've been doing projections of what would the reservoir levels be in a wet year, a normal year, and a dry year. But the one thing we don't know right now is how is runoff and increases in reservoir in relationship to storm events, because we just haven't had any storm events on which to develop that data. And throughout a wet season, we would expect that the runoff is going to be less up front until everything's saturated and then start increasing. So we don't have any specific projections that we can provide, just because the storm season hasn't, we haven't had much rain this year. So, but again, engaging with the technical advisory committee has sort of been our primary objective. So again, on that one, not much of an update.
Okay. I have some questions.
That's why I'm here.
We haven't had much rainfall, and I think that's a good thing in looking at how much capacity we have left in the reserve. But can you talk a little bit about our waterways on, like, for example, the Arroyo Grande Creek, and preparing those for when we do have releases during a storm? I mean, we do have enough data to know that if that creek is not clean and kept, you know, right, that those levees will pop, you know. And I know for a fact, and many people do, is that, you know, we have beavers in this area amongst other rodents and critters, and we all got to share. And the creek is a mess, I'm sorry. I walk the creek twice a week, and I know for a fact we have a minimum 12 beaver dams in the Oceano area. Yesterday, you know, everybody had been talking about the dam behind the sanitation district, but only 50 yards down there was another dam that had closed off the creek, and the water was coming over, cresting about 3 feet tall. And that was and I counted 11 trees down, and I'm talking about trees 9 to 11 inches in diameter, not you know, scrub brush trees, in, you know, probably an area the length of this table.
Subsequent to that basic vegetation clearing, which, you know, again, has to be within the environmental guidelines, we had a significant windstorms, I think it was in December. So we've gone out there, reinspected, and some of our road crews are going to be out there actually removing, and have already removed, some of the extra stuff that broke in the winds. Today we had people out there removing some of the beaver dams. It's interesting because you can remove a beaver dam and then 2 weeks later the beavers rebuilt the dam again. So it's kind of one of those things you got to just keep on top of. So there is a constant type of a maintenance program. And like in many things that are flood control related, whether it's cleaning the culverts and the flap gates that are within the levees themselves, we do the inspections in late summer. We try to get the stuff cleaned out. But again, because of the delay in rains, we've been back out there again, and we were removing some beaver dams again today. So,
great.
You know, it's a constant sort of a challenge.
Ongoing. And the reason effort. Why I bring it up is because, you know, it is our waterway, so it kind of does fall into the zone.
Well,
theoretically.
Quick conclusion, though, is that fortunately, the waterway management program, the EIR, was adopted in the fall of 2010 by the Board of Supervisors, and it's well into its permitting process. The Department of Water Resources, through the Integrated Regional Water Management Program, has awarded $2 million in grant funding in order to implement significant vegetation removal and sedimentation programs, and to increase the height of the levees and everything. So they actually gave us two grant awards, one underneath Proposition 1E, which is giving us then the ability to expand the scope of work for the Waterway Management Program, and even we got awarded more money than we were realistically thinking we could. So hopefully then that major work effort will be able to begin work in 2012, summertime. But right now it's just doing the basic vegetation clearing that we can do, but the big Waterway Management Program actually has significant removal of trees, taking out willows, trying to replace them with other trees like the sycamores, as well as major sedimentation removal and establishment of low flow channels and everything. So again, we're optimistic because we got some significant grant funding from the state to expand that program.
And the Zone 11A committee is involved and intricately involved in that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we update them on the details of those efforts at every meeting.
Because it is a very active committee, I think it is, and they've tried very hard to, you know, get down, you know, farther than the 22nd Street Bridge, I think, you know, permits restricting. But, okay, thanks.
Sure.
What about trapping the beavers and removing them?
I know that there's been some of that, but I also know that beavers are very abundant. I don't know, Katie, if you have anything to add on that, but nope, she doesn't.
It's
you can just keep going back.
They go across land.
They'll leave after
a while. I mean, literally, beavers are like everywhere in North America.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
No further questions? Okay. Brings us to item C, the 2012 meeting calendar.
Thank you, Chairman Costello. John Udotti, Public Works. This is the 2012 calendar for both the TAC and the Advisory Committee, and it also includes some of the items that will be discussed at the various meetings. So this is for informational purposes. I entertain any questions if you have any.
Anyone have any questions about the proposed schedule? Very good. Thank you. Well, get it all on our calendars. Moving along then, item 7, the capital projects update, the Rodriguez Bridge.
Thank you. So for an update on Rodriguez Bridge, I've spoken at the past meetings that one of the emergency plans was to have material ready and a manufactured bridge available for the event should either the pipe break or the bridge go down as well if the dam spills. We've purchased the material, about $12,000 in material, piping material. Bridge material is available as well, and we have a PO contract with a construction firm, so they're available within 5 days to repair the broken pipe should it break and strap it to the either existing bridge or on top of the new bridge that would be in place if that was to happen as well. As for the project, the fish passage and boulders that are the scope of the original project, plans are about 50% complete, and the working group that would work with myself, the Zone 3 Secretary, to review the bylaws. The bylaws were last updated in 1985, so review and possible changes are definitely warranted. And bringing this item before your committee to form a two- or three-person group to work with myself and bring back any proposed changes that you would take action on, and then those changes would go to the Board of Supervisors for final approval.
Okay, well, I guess we need to discuss who's interested in being on this bylaw committee.
I'll do it.
Okay. Chris is interested.
That may be too strong of a term, but...
I purposely said two or three because I didn't know what contractors wanted to participate, and we obviously can't have a quorum meeting, so three is the most, I think, might be appropriate, but two is fine with me as well.
And do we have any idea of what kind of schedule we'll have for a meeting to deal with this issue?
I'm anticipating two, three meetings at the most to go over the bylaws, make some corrections, and possibly bring it back at the next meeting.
Joe, I'd also like to sit on the committee.
Okay. Well, Mary, Lucy, and Chris Barnes, anyone else interested? Well, I think we'll keep it at two, not go to three. And we have our two volunteers. I'll leave it to you to work out the details in terms of timing and such, but we would anticipate that we'll have a report back in 2 months at the next meeting.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
So is the purpose of looking at the bylaws to allow more participation by Zone 3 and what's going on with the dam and everything? What's the purpose of it?
Well, I thought that maybe it was up for review since it hadn't been reviewed since 85, and a lot of, you know, infrastructure has been done in the county since Zone 3 was put in place. But I think what really made me kind of go, what are we doing here, is that the most input that this body has, what I could decipher from it, was a point of persuasion. And so that was all the strength that this advisory body could muster, not policies, procedures, no admin, anything like that. It was just a persuasion. And so if you're going to build a tier within your, you know, project or whatever, you know, you got to have a purpose. Otherwise, it's kind of a, an added extra level that you really don't need? Are we duplicating what RAC and TAC are doing? I mean, where is the duplication coming in? Where is our strengths? I know RAC reports to Board of Supes. Mm-hmm. TAC reports, I guess, to us. And we do what? So if we're going to do this, then I thought maybe we should have a little bit stronger purpose than one of persuasion.
Okay, that's what I wanted.
Yeah.
And I think the discussion has been held about there being some real teeth behind this board, this advisory board, and I think that's going to take a little bit more significant action than anything we take individually here, or take by this body. That will require Board of Supervisors participation and agreement. So let's start here. Here we go. Well, thank you for being willing to participate. I appreciate that. And let's see what this develops.
So we'll see a draft of this change before it's presented.
No, we're just going to arbitrarily do it. No. No, used to those moves too. No, we'll bring a draft back. Okay. Several.
Okay.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you. That brings us to item 9 now. Action items that might require, or that will require, subsequent Board of Supervisors action. First one is the recommendations to continue the HCP efforts.
It's me, again, Pablo. And in addressing the HCP efforts, you know, in addition to working with the TAC at that last meeting, I also, in following up with the update that I got from staff, called around to some of the other Zone 3 staff members. And in those subsequent discussions, we thought that addressing the HCP issue itself was maybe good in two steps, and that's why we have two different agenda items. I think in your package itself, we got them flip-flopped. The detailed report, which Mr. Hutchins Sage wanted, essentially says that, you know, again, he's reviewed the Jan Goldsmith's opinion from 2002 and basically still believes it's applicable. Before kind of doing the summary of how, you know, we see this and the recommendation, I also want to address what are we not addressing in this agenda item. And that's the other question that was out there, which is where's the language that we have in our water rights permit? If the assertion is that that's not correct and we have to get that modified, then why? And what's wrong with that permit? And so right now this is only focusing on the HCP and not on that other question associated with the water rights permit. And so we're envisioning at the next Zone 3 meeting we'll come back and discuss that some more. But on the water rights permit itself, in our review with County Council over the last couple weeks, they expressed something that was interesting and it was new to me. Because I think for quite some while, it was my understanding that the permit as written in the 1960s was incorrect, and we've been operating not quite in conformance with that. We've been operating as we should operate, but the language wasn't correct in the 1960s. And some of the feedback that I got from County Council is that they're not quite sure that perhaps actually the permit was written as it was intended in the 1960s, but the State Water Board's guidelines on how you do accounting for water may have been what has changed since the 1960s. And so it might be that the need to update the permit is really more driven based on its change in the State Water Board guidelines on direct diversions and diversions to storage. So those type of details will come back in 2 months and discuss a little bit more. One of the important questions, though, with regard to the HCP itself is, are we being forced to do the HCP just because we have to do an update to the water rights permit? That had the water rights permit been good today, Could the State Water Board still make us get into an HCP process? And so that's the 2002 opinion from Jan Goldsmith, which is like, well, it really doesn't matter what your water rights permit says, that yes, for the protection of endangered species, you can be put down this path anyhow. And the fact that the dam was constructed prior to the California Environmental Quality Act and prior to the Endangered Species Act doesn't really matter. You don't get grandfathered in that your flow regime still. Another way of saying it is that if we don't go through the HCP and if we don't get a take permit for the impacts that the operations of the dam might have on endangered species or the habitat of endangered species, and if there is a take, then we could be significantly responsible. And there's both civil and potential criminal responsibilities for impacts on endangered and threatened species. So the 2002 conclusion was, yes, you need to do the HCP, and legal counsel's recent review is still consistent with that. And so these are legal opinions. The other one on the, do we have to do the water availability analysis that the State Water Board is looking at, and we spoke briefly about that at a prior meeting, and in fact we had staff up over the last couple of days up in Sacramento to work on that with State Water Board staff. Is also related, but it's more of a technical issue associated with renewing the water rights permit. And then the third question, which the second one listed, is when we did the biological opinion on the seismic remediation project, did that address endangered species? And the answer, and even Anthony Spina sort of spoke this opinion when he was here maybe 2 years ago or so, is that biological opinion only addressed the seismic remediation project and that construction activity, and it didn't address the ongoing operations or the flows that go through the dam. So those are the three opinions that essentially are attached. Again, one is the Endangered Species Act. It doesn't matter that it's pre-Endangered Species Act. It doesn't matter the dam was constructed prior to California Environmental Quality Act. It doesn't matter if the language of the existing permit is perfect or whether it needs revision, that yes, we have to address the HCP and we have to address endangered species under any of those situations. You know, my general understanding that the precedent-setting case on this was the Mona Lake case, and part of it is the public trust doctrine, but council also says it's reconfirmed through a variety of statutes. So the first is, do we have to do the HCP? Even though the facility has existed for a long time, that one's answered. The biological opinion relating to the seismic remediation project, and that one's answered by council. And then the water availability analysis, and do we need to do that? And that one's answered. And I think that sort of when I reflected on it a little bit, I think that there's a certain amount of importance for reconfirming the general direction that we're going in, because certainly the Board of Supervisors expects us to get concurrence from advisory committees, especially significant advisory committees like Zone 3. But beyond the bylaws, there's also the contractual agreement that we have between the district and all of your agencies. And embodied into that is this issue that says, look, if we at the county are responding because we're being told by a competent entity, whether it's the Department of Public Health on our drinking water standards, or whether it's State Water Board because of water rights permit issues, or National Marine Fisheries Services on endangered species issues, embodied within the contracts itself states that, look, well, the county needs to do these things so we can fulfill our obligations to you. But if in the opinion of the agencies, you know, and especially through review with legal counsel, the idea is, well, look, we don't really agree and legal counsel doesn't agree, you do have the contractual right to, and this is my layman's understanding, basically to step into the shoes of the county and to turn to those agencies and say, wait, hold on a second. No, you don't have the authority to exercise that control and to make these demands of us. And so that's embodied in some of the language which speaks to when we undertake additional projects, and certainly the HCP is a project underneath, you know, the need to have a CEQA document and environmental review and everything. It's not a physical project, but it still definitely applies. But when a competent government authority shall direct such additional projects, improvements, or repairs, the district, the agency, and the other agency shall be afforded a notice there and the opportunity to oppose the imposition of such requirement before a court of competent jurisdiction. And that was something that was renegotiated in early 2000s because, as John's going to work with you and saying, hey, what are appropriate updates to the bylaws? Because the bylaws haven't been updated in many, many, many years. Well, the contracts have been updated, certainly more recently. They were updated in order to make sure that everything was in order to do the seismic remediation project. And the back and forth during those negotiations, which included, you know, work with your staff and with attorneys representing your agencies at that point in time, this is one of the critical issues. It was that if the Zone 3 agencies didn't agree with this regulatory agency, so for example, imposing a requirement on the county and on Zone 3, that you'd be afforded the opportunity to, again, essentially step into the county's shoes. And so I think that that's an important reason why, then again, County Council has agreed to release the legal opinions, which is not very often. But, again, it provides then the ability for those to be shared with the legal counsel of the various agencies, looked at and seen, you know, whether or not the legal counsel is in concurrence as well. So, you know, from everything we've heard and all of our consultations with legal counsel and the variety of the questions that, yeah, we think the HCP is something that's necessary. We would seek, you know, just the general endorsement of continuing the HCP efforts. I would also understand that if you guys, if it's your desires for the next couple months to have your attorneys look at those legal opinions, then it would make sense to sort of defer that action for the next meeting and have Mr. Hutchinson and Katie Drexage continue with the detailed work efforts that they are doing. But the last thing that I addressed in the staff report is that there is so much detail and effort associated with something like a habitat conservation plan. And one of the challenges that we're finding right now is the ability to really run through those details at any given TAC meeting or at any Zone 3 meeting, because we'll come and we'll sort of, you know, do our general presentations. And the last thing we want to be perceived as, although it's an easy perception to develop sometimes, is that we're asking your committee or the TAC to rubber stamp our recommendations. We have no desire for that whatsoever, and yet given the volume of details, I think it is appropriate to warrant consideration of a subcommittee to really look into the details. To me, the one detail at this point in time that is probably most important is that flow regime itself. How does it operate? Under what conditions are we making downstream releases for the environment? In what situations are we not making downstream releases to the environment, holding them back and everything? Because the bottom line, that equates then to what's the reliability of the water supply for your agencies moving into the future. And the consultants and the technical professionals are stating that they're developing a plan which, in fact, maintains the reliability of the supply as you currently have. But that confidence level, in my mind, is a good thing about the financial risks of the HCP is that the program calls for a set dollar amount per year. And that way, it helps to mitigate the financial risks. What the program doesn't call for is a list of the projects that we would have to implement, like, in a five-year period. Because if the HCP said, you know, the county in Zone 3 has to implement these five projects within a five-year period, then there would be a greater degree of financial risk associated with the HCP, because now we have timetables associated with specific projects, and if those projects themselves cost more than we anticipated, then that's a financial risk. But in this situation, that financial risk, again, is mitigated because it calls for sinking funds where there's just a specific dollar allocation every year. So when I look at the HCP in its totality, and I think about, okay, where do I think there's risks and uncertainties? Because in everything that we do in life, there's a certain degree of risks and uncertainty. I think that there's less risks and uncertainty on the financial side of the equation, but the issue about the water supply itself, and that's what we want to make sure is really available on a long-term basis so that the Zone 3 agencies are getting the water that you're buying, And that flow regime, which in last year Anthony Spina gave us the general nod that he's satisfied with, well, now I think this is the time that if there is a subcommittee really to scour through in detail, that would be what it is the flow regime. So that's my presentation. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Two questions. One, thanks for the presentation or update. One, and I may have asked this question before, do you envision that there's going to be any changes to the flow regime as it's been developed so far based on the findings of the WA/CFII? The water availability analysis/cumulative flow impairment index?
You know, it's hard for me to say that I would anticipate any changes, but I do think that that's the sort of the critical area, because Mark will be, I don't know if you're going to get into the flow regime tonight or not, Mark, but the idea is that depending on what the reservoir storage, how much water is behind the reservoir and what kind of a year we're having, then that dictates how much water we would be releasing for the environment. And so in wet years and in normal years and when storage reservoirs are, you know, relatively healthy, the answer is we don't see risks that the water availability analysis is going to modify the flow regime that's been developed so far. It's in the years where the reservoir levels are very low and when we're not getting much inflow is where the real question exists. Because in that situation, we know that everything is dry, and there is a scenario there that we would not release all of the water that inflows into the dam. We would maintain storage of some of that water. The water availability analysis and that review at the State Water Board will then help us address is that appropriate, or is it that we're potentially in that situation not releasing water that should go downstream for those who have downstream water rights. So in its totality, we don't see that the water availability analysis should change the regime, but in very dry years, or in dry years when the reservoir levels are really low, is where the question, I think, remains. And part of this future effort is going to tell us the answer to that.
Thank you, Mr. Egerman. And the second question is, looking at the efforts so far with the HCP, and compare that to maybe some of the other adjoining jurisdictions, let's say Santa Barbara County, Ventura County, or Monterey to the north, have any of those jurisdictions have gone through this HCP process for some type of operation schedule for
steelhead?
For a reservoir that they operate?
No, our understanding is we're the furthest southerly operations that is going through this for steelhead.
Okay. But jurisdictions to the north have done this, have gone through this perhaps?
That's right. Our understanding is some that up in Northern California have. Again, Mark might be able to cite them better. The one thing that's unique here is that it's not a creek or a river that flows continuously 365 days out of the year. So even though others have gone through it, we still have a unique characteristics and unique flows. In my discussions when I was in Sacramento, I don't know, 2 months ago, and talking with State Water Board staff about the water availability analysis, there's like it's a water code or a 1707 petition, and I can't remember the specific citation, but they asked me, well, have you established minimum flows throughout the entire year? To the ocean. So even then, the State Water Board staff went, whoa, you know, it kind of took them back a little bit, because I think they quickly recognized that, you know, we're going so far down south here on the steelhead issues that it was unique in comparison to some of the other projects that they'd been working on. So, and that's the thing about habitat conservation plans and often even regular Section 7 permits and everything is that they're case specific. You really have to look at the biology of the specific area and address it on a case by case. So even though some have been done, there's really nothing that fits as a good example to what we're working with here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Egerman. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I see no more questions.
Oh, I got one.
Take it back.
Pablo, I kind of gained the impression during your presentation that every watershed with a reservoir with steelhead is going to have to do an HCP. Is that a correct interpretation?
Well, I certainly think that if we have to do an HCP, that and if the protections of endangered species are so important, that certainly many others should have to as well. I don't know that the resource agencies are going to require all of them to do it. We know that you know, the Central Coast itself, with reestablishment of whether it's, you know, some of the sea lions or the otters up in the North Coast, and Coastal Commission, you know, approaches to the Central Coast, resource agencies do consider the Central Coast to be, you know, part of the environmentally pristine area of the California's coast. And so from that perspective, it wouldn't surprise me if they impose requirements that they can impose on us, where they might let other areas go that maybe are already considered lost causes or something like that. But you would think that if any creek that has the potential to sustain an endangered species, they would be addressing it. Salinas River didn't go through the HCP process so much as they went through Section 7 because of Monterey County Water Resource Agency built the dam, between the city of Salinas and the ocean, and they finished construction on that just a couple years ago. It was a dam that was constructed in order to help with recharge and to try to tackle their seawater intrusion issue. I can't remember which Monterey County program it's part of. But in that case, since they were constructing a new dam, they addressed the steelhead requirements as part of their Section 7 requirements, but they still nevertheless did it. And Monterey County today has a fish biologist that's on staff because, of course, the Salinas River is much longer, and they do a lot of work. You know, they do their fish counts, they relocate fish, they make releases in order to help promote the smolting process, I think what it's called. So even though they didn't go through the HCP, they went through the Section 7 permitting process. Certainly their work efforts associated with trying to help with the recovery of steelhead are very quite extensive.
Yes.
I don't know if this is more a comment or just a reflection on your presentation, but you had an awful lot of references to legal opinions as to why we should be doing the HCP. Why did you bring that up after all this time? I understand this is a process that's been going on for a long time. Is there some reason that somebody's now questioning why we should even be doing this?
Yeah, and I think it's kind of normal that when you get into long-term processes that sometimes you do get the questions that came up in 2002, you know, again resurfaced recently. Why are we doing the HCP? And so we wanted to make sure to sort of provide that update and sort of a reminder of we addressed it previously, but again, it's a good thing to readdress because sometimes we get so immersed in the details, you know, of what we're doing that we forget to remind ourselves of why we're doing it. So that's why we thought it would be appropriate to make sure to address that issue so that then Mark and Katie can focus in on, you know, the details of what we're doing on the HCP.
Okay, thanks.
Is it the county's intention to form a committee?
I think it's a good idea, but again, it's sort of at the pleasure of you know your committee itself.
So what's the purpose of the subcommittee then?
So our challenge is that we'll come and we'll do presentations either to Zone 3 itself or to the Technical Advisory Committee, and those presentations will be one of many items on an agenda. And it's really hard to drill down into the details of what we're doing. And working with any group, you know, we don't want to be perceived as just sort of wanting to get a rubber stamp so we can run to the Board of Supervisors and get something approved. Mark's, you know, recommendation and our recommendation on the next item is for us to...
Redundant, yeah.
I think so.
Well, I think at this point it looks like there's no perceived need to progress with a subcommittee. However, should that change, we will reserve the right to revisit that.
Sorry.
Mr. Chisholm.
dwarfism with the city of Pismo Beach. If the county is willing, this item might be forwarded on to the TAC for a subcommittee of the TAC that might be able to work with the county staff, and that might be a more appropriate use of time as a way of advising the advisory board, if that would work out better.
That seems like a reasonable suggestion, that perhaps the TAC would have a subcommittee and they could brief us as needed.
I'm supportive of that. That's fine.
I'm not supportive of that. I'm sorry. Whether it's redundant here or it's redundant in the subcommittee, it's still redundant. I would ask that this be held back at least till a draft of the policies and procedures can be done. We don't even know if this board is needed at this point. I mean, I'm not fully convinced. I mean, I think the staff is doing fine on this. They have been for 10 years now, 8 years, however long. It seems like more and more work for the same people. I don't know. I'm not supporting it at this point, just because I don't understand what your point is. What can the same people in a different room provide differently?
Well, I mean, I would think that this board provides more of administrative function or administrative oversight. And that if the technical advisory committee, which focuses more on many of the specific technical details, especially those related to the HCP effort, and some of those have, you know, such as Mr. Chisholm, which have a engineering background, that can really help work out some of the detailed issues associated with the effort. I see that there's utility in that. We don't really have the time, and we don't have the time to do that in this venue.
Well, I have a comment on that. Don't you meet with your TAC representative and get a little synopsis of what's going on beforehand, so that they can explain anything that you might have a question about?
Is that a question to me?
Yeah.
No.
Oh. So when you get this information and you have any questions about it, you don't ask anybody about it?
No, I ask them here.
Oh, that's interesting. Because I ask beforehand to have things explained. And that's basically what you're asking a subcommittee to do, the TAC, right?
I was under the impression that the Technical Advisory Committee would be focusing on specific issues relative to the HCP completion.
True, but then that's what I ask also. Everything that's involved in this before we come forward here, everything that's, you know, on the agenda, I ask about, and that included the HCP.
Well, certainly we all have the opportunity to do that with our TAC representatives. And I guess perhaps the issue might be that the TAC is probably in a better position to ask specific questions. They meet more regularly. I don't know that we necessarily need to have a subcommittee, but just perhaps if the TAC, we just request or make sure that the TAC pursues anything that we're looking for here. A subcommittee might not be necessary. We already have the TAC. The TAC can pursue this in their regular meetings.
I guess my feeling is we ought to leave it up to the TAC to set a subcommittee or not.
Makes sense to me.
Well, why don't we leave it at that? And if the TAC feels that this requires a subcommittee, that can be pursued. If they need our support for that, we'll take that up the next meeting and discuss that.
You know, we've used that persuasion.
Okay. Are we satisfied with this?
Yep.
Okay, then we'll move along. Thank you. Brings us to item B here. The Habitat Conservation Plan Status Report with recommendations to endorse the attached draft contract with H.C. Harvey and Associates. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we did.
This is good.
Members of the committee, Good evening. I'm Mark Hutchinson. I'm the Environmental Programs Manager for Department of Public Works. In May and September, I put work status update. We hope to be well underway with the HCP. And as issues come up that require decisions and recommendations by your advisory committee, we would use those periods to bring them to you. Obviously, each of your meetings is preceded by two TAC meetings, and it would be our intent to discuss these topics at the TAC at one or both of those meetings before we come to your advisory committee so that we have the full impact or input from the technical advisory committee members. I do apologize for tonight's presentation. There's three major topics there to try to catch us up to where the HCP is in the process. In 2 months, in March, I would bring to you a presentation on the downstream release program. After having gone over it in detail with the TAC, as Pablo mentioned, that is a key element of this effort. It is one thing that has occupied the efforts of the staff and the TAC for the last 4 or 5 years, and Stetson Engineers negotiating that release program with the National Marine Fisheries Service. And as we know, we're waiting on the water availability analysis to let us know what, if any, changes we might need to make to it. So we felt it's critical for everyone involved in the project to have the opportunity to have a good presentation on that, and for the staff and the TAC especially to understand and have a great deal of confidence in how it was prepared and what the effects on the water supply for your communities actually is. July 19th, a refresher, not necessarily teaching the ins and outs of the Federal Endangered Species Act, but touch on that, some background on it, and then try to relate it to what we're more familiar with on the Central Coast, the CEQA process, and then hopefully graphically illustrate how those things work together, how the federal environmental analysis process will work on an HCP, and then talk a little bit about some of the related statutes that we need to be aware of and that will come into play as we move through both finalizing the HCP and ultimately implementing it. So I put the wonderful acronyms for California Endangered Species Act up there, as well as the National Historic Preservation Act, and then ran out of space for any more acronyms, but there'll be several more that we'll want to be aware of. And then finally, on November 15th, we need to look at the resource agency post-submittal process, what happens to our HCP after we have it complete, we believe, and submit it to the agencies, what the agencies do, what the guidelines are that they use to evaluate the document, and also perhaps develop some strategies on how we might respond to any requests that they have for us or into any timeline issues that might arise. By that I mean that the agencies typically are well overextended and sometimes have difficulties adjusting their priorities to our needs, and I think we're well positioned with the number of communities involved to perhaps help them set a higher priority for our efforts. With that, I do have three topics. We'll talk about the scope and content of the HCP as it currently exists. What is it now that we're back onto all these other topics beyond the downstream release program? What is it that we're proposing to do? Very briefly, I hope. I want to report to you on the results of the November interagency meeting that occurred 1 week after your last meeting. And then move to tonight's recommendation, which is to contract with the H.T. Harvey & Associates to move the HCP onto a submittal document. First off, the 2004 Draft Habitat Conservation Plan, that's a document that was prepared by Stetson and Hansen Environmental, submitted to the agencies in 2004 and triggered National Marine Fisheries Service's detailed involvement in the core of our effort, which is the downstream release program. The need for the Habitat Conservation Plan, as we've heard, is essentially the federal requirement that we either avoid impacts to federally listed species, those that are threatened and endangered, or have permits to take those species or affect their habitat in a way that alters their essential life cycles. We have three listed endangered species in the creek below Lopez Dam, steelhead trout, red-legged frog, and the tidewater goby. Ultimately, that's a nice picture of a red-legged frog. that is the largest native frog in the West, not the largest frog because they're being displaced by bullfrogs. They were once very widely distributed in California. They are essentially gone from the foothills and gone from Southern California. Pablo mentioned that many resource agencies have a special place in their hearts for San Luis Obispo County. We do seem to have a very healthy and intact population of red-legged frogs in most of our streams and waterways, much to the chagrin of some of the folks who are trying to use their land here. But we can that focus is because outside of this county, practical difference in how they're treated by National Marine Fisheries Service. There was a question earlier about HCPs in other jurisdictions. There is one other HCP in California. It was prepared by the Humboldt Bay Municipal Water Company for their operations on the Mad River. They do have an approved HCP there. We know that, obviously, Monterey County Water Resources Agency, the Nacimiento Dam, and the project Pablo mentioned dealt with steelhead. I can report that the Sonoma County Water Agency on the Russian River has altered their operations substantially because of steelhead trout issues, and we expect that they will be moving towards an HCP. The National Marine Fisheries Service has been focused on what's called recovery plans for these species. We expect that as recovery plans are adopted, then the focus on agencies involved with water diversions and the push to complete HCPs will start to increase. The recovery plan for the Southern California steelhead, that is Santa Maria South, has just been completed and noticed by National Marine Fisheries Service for public comment. Once that is adopted, they'll move to the next area, which is ours, and then on up the coast. Another major area that they are involved with steelhead is on the Columbia River and a series of dams there. My interpretation of that is that they are working through multiple federal court cases to actually get court decisions on all aspects of HCPs and Section 7 consultations for steelhead. And as that litigation draws to a close, they'll have a very strong roadmap for what they can and should be doing. So we can expect that in California, water agencies, especially along the coast, will be learning what HCPs are all about, just as we have done.
Can I interrupt for just a moment?
Yeah.
I hear you saying there are several federal cases out there in the courts right now on this issue. Does our HCP need to wait for those to be resolved before it goes forward? Or will we come up with an HCP, get it approved, and then have court decisions that may affect it and change it?
I haven't seen anything yet that's on point for our HCP. The issues don't really point at what we're doing. Ours is significantly less complex than some of those issues. A lot of those, by the way, have to do with exactly what we've done, though, which is the downstream release program, how much water, when, and why. And I think we're in a good position as far as those issues, well out in front of some of the things that are happening on the Columbia River especially.
Okay. The falls, too.
Thank you. Sorry for the interruption.
And I should mention, I have three-part, obviously it's your option as the chairman as to when you want to stop me and do questions.
It just seemed relevant right then.
So I put a brief timeline up here, beginning when Lopez Dam was constructed and the Endangered Species Act passed. Key issue is when these species were listed. The Endangered Species Act really didn't affect us until listed species didn't arrive but were listed. So we have those dates of 94, 96, and 97. The 98 revised water rights application, which triggered state water board saying you need to do an HCP, that's now back down, and we're back to the basic issue of take and permitting for endangered species, and then the initial draft in 2004. The HCP itself is relatively straightforward in the basics. It's a three-part proposal. One is the water release program, which is the key part. The HCP also proposes various habitat enhancement actions, activities downstream from the dam to make the habitat for fish better. The general concept of the downstream release in the habitat is to try to match natural flow patterns and improve habitat conditions to maximize, I'll say, population resilience, because the HCP does provide 4 years when downstream releases would significantly be curtailed to the extent that fish would not be able to survive in the stream. That, however, also does match natural conditions in Arroyo Grande Creek, and Pablo touched on that. The flow model itself, as you read through it, has two fundamental elements. The first is to maintain the safe and reliable water supply, and the second is to provide a year-round minimum in-stream flow that keys to natural conditions, again, dry seasons, dry periods, wet periods, all of which can be tracked by the level of water in the lake. The habitat enhancements are nothing that we would call a major project that you would be able to point to or identify, certainly nothing as large as a levee or a dam or a diversion or anything. Talks about removing passage barriers, stabilizing stream banks and enhancing the stream side, riparian corridors, doing other actions that would include improve water quality, perhaps working with the streamside landowners if there's erosion issues and that sort of stuff. And then it has a category of other habitat enhancement, which at the moment is undefined. Some of the partial barriers to steelhead that are identified in the HCP and other documents are standing underneath the bridge. The waterfall is actually the concrete encasement of the water pipe. And that's about a total of about a 2-foot drop. It makes it difficult for fish in that the water falls onto a flat concrete apron, so there's no plunge pool for them to get a run at jumping up over the waterfall. That project's designed, CEQA process is complete. Regulatory applications are with the agencies, and we're looking at construction this summer. That project is also important to me because we will have not only cost estimates but actual construction bids in hand, and ultimately we'll know the complete and total cost of that, which we intend to relate back to the funding options that are currently in the HCP, and I'll talk about that a little bit. And then this is a atypical section of Arroyo Grande Creek where there is little to no riparian vegetation, and so the document talks about enhancing riparian zones in areas like this, but it has no specifics on which zones, where, or when. And then just a brief graphic of the kind of in-stream improvements that HCPs typically would call for, as ours does. This shows a rock weir to create a pool where fish could summer over with the root wad to create a little bit of a swirl to deepen the pool, downstream some in-stream structures that also create good fish habitat. The district or the county itself has recently installed similar items in Santa Rosa Creek and Cambria, where we've just completed a project to remove what was known as the Ferrasky Road crossing. It was an Arizona-type crossing through the creek that on agency lists was the number one worst fish passage barrier in the county, other than the dams, which we don't intend to remove. And that project is completed. Financial commitments, this again from the document, it identifies the conservation account. This is the money that would be used to fund things like the Rio Grande Gauge or Rodriguez Crossing if we weren't doing that, and other fish passage improvements. It does specify $50,000 annually for the 20-year life of the document. It does not include any cost estimates for these improvements. So my reference to Rodriguez was we will use that to get much tighter estimates on what these things actually do cost to confirm that these amounts either adequate or perhaps too much money for what they propose. The document also proposes a companion monitoring account funded at the same level, but interestingly is very light on information about exactly how that would be used. So we would propose in moving forward that we'd be very clear, and H.D. Harvey's identified that as a deficiency, by the way, that these accounts and any commitments or any timelines be very clear and concise. And, of course, we would not want to make any financial commitments key to projects unless we know what those projects are actually likely to cost.
Yes.
On these commitments, once something has been repaired, such as, you know, improving Rodriguez waterline crossing or, you know, working with the Rio Grande Gauge, is there money in there for maintenance, like if something happens to it?
Well, that's one of the items that's not covered in the HCP at this moment. Some of these improvements, for instance, the Rodriguez crossing, when we look at the design of that, once it's initially constructed and then you have that 3 to 5 year vegetation maintenance, we go in and replant the banks and take care of that stuff to get it established. It's the type of structure that should not require substantial maintenance. But HCPs now, as opposed to when this was written in 2004, have evolved to the point where you write in exactly what's going to happen if, for instance, there was a major flood and all the other damage that happens, our Rodriguez Crossing is our repair project's completely destroyed. That's all defined in the document these days. It's just not left to the question of, you know, are we on the hook to maintain it forever? How do we go about adjusting to accommodate or compensate for those kinds of things? So currently not accommodated for or explained, but the intent would be to clarify that kind of issue, which is an obvious question.
I have one question on your commitments. I do agree on not going long-term commitment, and that's why is the 20 years just an example that you're using there?
The HCPs have a term. So the HCP Habitat Conservation Plan leads to an incidental take statement and an implementation agreement, which functions as a permit.
Uh-huh.
And typically, all of those have a period of years that they're valid for.
Right.
So the term of the HCP, the 20 years, is also one of those issues that needs to be better supported. In its current form, the HCP is an important document. That was really the main focus of the meeting. It was in Ventura. That is where the nearest Fish and Wildlife field office is. We met scheduled for 3 hours. It went a little bit long, maybe half an hour long. And there's the purpose, and this was a slide right from the presentation. I should note that the attachments to your staff report, which again are quite lengthy, but we included the agenda for this meeting, who attended. We handed out a stack of additional documents that are important for them to have in the file, and also a copy of that 3-hour PowerPoint is in your packet. We wanted to initiate discussions on some general topics, and we wanted to put our schedule out there because it has actions for the agencies and see if anybody jumped up and down and objected to that. So again, we had two representatives from National Marine Fisheries Service, Mr. Spina, who most of you are familiar with, and to my knowledge has been with this project from the beginning, and he brought with him Kristen Mull, who's obviously new to the effort. I think as Mr. Spina moves up in the agency, some of his day-to-day involvement will be handed off. David Simmons and Jeff Phillips are senior employees with U.S. Fish and Wildlife in Ventura. And as we expected, they have not been involved with this HCP before, so this was a complete new introduction to them. I'm sure they're aware of it. So that's why that PowerPoint includes things like aerial photos that walk you down the creek and maps that show you where Randy Creek is and stuff. We wanted to put that into their minds and into their files. Sharon Kramer from H.T. Harvey, who's the proposed consultant project manager, came down from Arcata and attended the meeting. We did have an opportunity to meet with her for about half an hour before and then had a lunch meeting afterwards. That was my first face-to-face meeting with the consultant. And I just wanted to confirm my perceptions of the firm and the staff assigned that they're competent people. As I was talking, which I'm wont to do during the meeting, Sharon was observing body language from the agency reps and making detailed notes. And we talked a little bit about some of those responses at our lunch meeting. And then Mitchell Moody from the State Water Board started out on the phone, although at the end of 3.5 hours he wasn't there anymore. I don't know if he left or fell asleep at his desk or what. He didn't participate other than listen. He's not an environmental person, so I think his intent was to just learn a little more about what's going on in San Luis Obispo County. And then, of course, Katie and I representing the district. We took him through the project background, a summary of our proposal, much like I just did. We got into the document a little bit with some specific questions, explained where to Fish and Wildlife where we've been for the last 7 years, and focused on some variables and related efforts. They're aware of other things going on in the county and in the watershed, and we wanted to make sure that they understood the differences between, for instance, the HCP and the Waterway Management Plan or oceanal flooding or those kinds of things that are going on. We slowed down and focused on some of these issues. because they're concerns of ours, and they were also identified in the H.T. Harvey peer review document, which is also included as an attachment to your staff report. I would note, didn't mean to be sneaky, but we did not tell the agencies that these are the issues that our consultant felt were deficient. We just wanted to put them out in front and get their independent response. And there was no significant disagreement from those that had opinions with what the consultant was feeling needed to be done. In some areas, we were able to say, well, is this appropriate or does this need to be backed up? And in other areas, it was simply a discussion of what needs to be included, for instance, in the conservation program, just to confirm that what we have on our scope of work for the consultant matches agency expectations. We talked about some of these variables. We let them know what's up with the water availability analysis and what we expect the timeline to be. On NEPA, which is the National Environmental Policy Act, their version of CEQA, I wanted to get more information on them. Confirmed that National Marine Fisheries would be the lead agency. That makes U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service what NEPA calls a cooperating agency. We wanted to put the issue of document level out there and make our pitch that an EIS, environmental impact statement, is not necessary, that we haven't seen anything in it, and then talk about their process for getting a NEPA document done and also get the references to their regulations that tell us how that's going to happen. And then we talked about what's happening Zone 11A, the Oceana Lagoon, and what we know about the off-road vehicle parks HCP effort for steelhead that was started some years ago and stopped, and we think may be starting up again. We talked about where we are. We talked about the internal transition from one department to another. Also took a moment to explain to them who you folks are and what Zone 3 is and how it relates to what they perceive as the county of San Luis Obispo and how we're staffed for both agencies. So as a result, well, we did re-engage the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, so they're back in the game. We didn't see objections to the schedule. They didn't raise any new issues that we hadn't heard about before. After talking around the issue a little bit, we ended up back at the general opinion of the agencies, again, qualified without having detailed information that 20 years is where you start with a permit duration. They did question the boundary limits. National Marine Fisheries did. Right now, the HCP coverage, according to the document, extends to the top of Zone 1, and according to the maps in the document, extends to Highway 1, which is different boundaries. And it's the question of whether it needs to go to the ocean or not. And obviously, that's going to take some more careful consideration before we make a decision one way or the other. And if the TAC, by the way, forms a subcommittee, that's one of those issues we need to get deeply into about the implications of what we do and don't do with the boundary. I was very pleased with the consultants' interactions with the agencies and our ability to talk with them at a very informed level about HCPs. I think they understand that we, if we contract with H.T. Harvey, that we do have people that are very top-notch in the field. So that's it for that part of the presentation, and we're on to the last piece, which is the H.T. Harvey contract. This is one of those slides that's meant to show you that there's a lot of work to be done. I'm not going to read all the details. Now, we did put their proposed scope and cost estimate in your package along with that peer review document. Major areas of the work, they're going to not necessarily revise the project description but clean up all of those areas that we just talked about. There's some HCP requirements and specific ways of doing things. So the environmental setting needs to be adjusted. The conservation plan, again, unique to HCPs, needs to be fleshed out and focused. And then there's a take assessment. The document seems to assume that operating the dam takes results in impacts negative to endangered species, but is very light on exactly how and when that occurs. And we all understand that we talk a lot about low water years, you know, when the creek slows down and we're not releasing a lot of water, and fish strand and fish die and lack of oxygen. But when you compare those impacts to natural conditions, it's very difficult to lay that blame on the operations of the dam because it's very close to what would be occurring in the stream naturally. The dam actually has the effect of reducing the number of years that the stream has low flow. That's borne out by the downstream release program. So we need to get a bit more sophisticated and explain how our diversion and storage of water and perhaps reducing the peak flows from moderate-sized storms actually does affect habitat and then thereby the fish. And that will then feed back into the conservation program and our mitigation programs. Their cost estimate is $260,000, 877. I estimate staff costs at about $60,000. This $320,000 over the next approximately 18 months. Funding, as we discussed 2 months ago, the current year HCP budget, which we're somewhat under, is $126,000. The proposed budget keeps that level, no increase there. And that the remaining costs would come from the district reserves, which are currently $1.9 million. Things that we need to be tracking very closely as we proceed, the variables, obviously the water availability analysis, when's it going to be done and what's the effect going to be on us. We'll need to be tracking resource agency response times. We intend to pick up the pace, and we need to work with them so that they can also get into that same mode. The environmental review costs. CEQA is a document that we'll prepare at the county, and we can control those. The NEPA process with the agency requires us to hire a consultant of their choosing. They approve the scope. We pay for the consultant, and it cannot be the same consultant that we hired to do the HCP. That's partly our concern with their initial very tentative assessment of doing a full environmental impact statement. I'm getting ahead of myself on my CEQA and NEPA presentation. We all know the difference between a mitigated negative deck and an environmental impact report. The difference between, on the federal side, what's called a finding of no significant impact and an environmental impact statement is magnitudes greater. An EIS is a very complicated, long-term, complex, and ultimately expensive document to produce. And neither Katie nor I, or no one else in my office at this point, has seen anything that would indicate an EIS is appropriate. Also, the threshold for doing an EIS is much higher than we would typically see for an EIR. We need to be careful if the agencies start thinking there needs to be new environmental technical reports. Our reports, initial assessments are old, 12 years, but at least one of them has been fully updated over the years by other agencies, and there's been a lot of work done up and down the.
So is it right now the idea is that the NEPA document would be a separate document, or is it going to be a joint document that would be prepared?
It would be a separate document.
Okay.
I've gone to all of those seminars where they talk about joint documents. I've been involved in joint document preparation, not with these agencies. Those that know me know that my term for joint CEQA NEPA documents is disaster. Never seen it work the way it's been promoted. And we all have word processors, and we can copy text from one to the other and make them separate. Works much better that way. And I think the agencies are not at all familiar with the concept. They didn't express, I think it did come up in our conversation. I may have asked the question. So I would see the NEPA document as a standalone, but all of the information in it would be provided principally from the technical documents of the HCP itself. There's some different analysis that has to go on, and it's a little difficult at times because the perspective on similar concepts is different between the two documents.
And NOAA would be the lead, the federal lead?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a question I think probably Pavel would be better equipped to answer, and that would regard the funding source for this this expenditure. I'm a little uncomfortable without further explanation, I guess, on how that funding works. Why, for instance, the fact we've got $1.9 million in district reserves now, it's okay to take $200,000 out. We don't need to refund it, or do we need to refund it? And if not, why not?
That, yeah.
Maybe Pablo could give us some insight on that.
Certainly. The district-funded reserves, as I mentioned in a prior item, that prior to the seismic remediation project, we renegotiated all the Zone 3 contracts. And that $1.9 million is essentially the reserves that remained from prior to that renegotiation. The prior to the new contracts, reserves would be built up sometimes because we would ask agencies to make contributions, but a lot of them were in substance were because of the property tax allocation that came into Zone 3 and then the annual interest income. With the renegotiated contracts, what we promised to do is to take all the property taxes and essentially the interest income too and dedicate them to the debt service on the seismic remediation project. That strategy was sort of twofold. One is, at the time, we saw the state of California taking property taxes from, you know, local agencies, doing the property tax shifts, often going to school districts. But to the extent that property taxes were obligated to debt service, it helped to preclude the state from doing some shifts. And so we thought, okay, if we could try to figure out a mechanism here to take the Zone 3 property tax allocations, dedicate them to debt service and reduce the debt service costs, then maybe that would help us if the state was going to shift some money again. It's kind of a strategy, and whether it would actually work out or not was, you know, dependent on how crafty the state would get, I guess. But that was part of it. Obviously, part of it was that there's going to be new debt service costs associated with the seismic project, and so to mitigate the annual budgetary implications on everybody was important as well. But the third component really was, well, to the extent that new reserves are really necessary, then in the new contracts, we call those agency-funded or contractor-funded reserves, where we would have to explicitly come to Zone 3 and say, we need to start building up reserves for a specific purpose and justify it to your committee and then be able to incorporate it into the budget. So then it left the question of, oh, what do we do with this money then that is already in reserves when we renegotiate the contract? And those were defined as district-funded reserves. They were set aside, and the idea was they weren't really earmarked for anything specifically, but just simply set aside in case a need came up, an unforeseen need came up in the future in order to help address that need. So with the balance today being about $1.9 million and the need for stable budgets and stable billing, and as Jenny had mentioned, you know, we've kept O&M down to less than 1% increase, and we've got some cost reductions on some other things, so we've been able to really kind of keep a flat budget here. The idea is, well, how about using some of those district reserves for this cost as a way, again, of keeping the billings down to all your agencies relatively flat, again, considering the current economic times. But along those lines, there is really never a reimbursement of the district-funded reserves, that if some other reserves develop, a need for other reserves develop in the future, then we would, you know, seek recommendations and proposals to include those in the budget, and then those would be contractor-funded reserves. There is a little bit that's in the budget that you'll see for proposed next year in order to start building up a little bit of reserves for equipment replacement. At the water treatment plant, because we've been operating the treatment plant now for about 5 years about it, but in this case, I think it's an appropriate recommendation.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Can you just go back for a second and tell me which organization it was that was going to review the scopes of work and have final say on the consultants that were used? Was that NIMS or was that NEPA?
For the NEPA document.
For the NEPA document?
The lead federal agency, which is National Marine Fisheries Service, or NIMS, or
yeah.
NOAA Fisheries, as they're known, would have the final say on that scope.
Even though it's our resources that are paying for it?
Right. So
do
we
they
would
have
use
it like a federally approved list of consultants that they consider experts or
well,
I mean,
typically, federal procurement regulations require an RFP process.
Correct.
And I'm not aware that they have any pre-approved consultants. And I'm sure that since the project would be paying for the cost, that we would have some input into costs and scope, and perhaps even if there are consultants that we strongly objected to.
Yeah, I'm not saying to sole source with their list. That's not what I'm asking. I'm just asking, do they already have an existing list?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. Because a lot of the agencies, federal and state, you know, if you're going to use consultants and they're going to be involved in that much of the proposals, right, they usually will have a list of, you know.
Oh, certainly, yeah. If the agency does a lot of work with consultants, sometimes
they have a list of who they accept or, you know.
Right.
Things like that. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Hutchinson, the presentation that was presented to the agency representatives at the November 22nd meeting, there's a number of slides and pictures. Has that been presented to the TAC?
I believe the TAC has copies of the presentation.
We may not have shared
that with them.
Are you going to give the TAC a more detailed presentation about the HCP, more of the technical components in the near future?
Well, I talked to the TAC, essentially gave them the presentation parts A and B of this previously. And we intend to talk to the TAC definitely about the technical components.
Okay.
They did discuss the idea of being more involved in the technical details. It's just an issue that Katie and I and perhaps the consultant will be looking in detail at things. And we tend to come to the TAC with a recommendation to see if that's reasonable before we come to the advisory committee. And I think at least one or more members of the TAC may be interested in being in on it earlier to help understand our thinking and the processes that we go through. Of course, we understand that they, like everyone else, are very, very busy and time is limited. But I can foresee issues as we move through the HCP that to have the viewpoint of members of the TAC would be very valuable, not just to verify our thinking or our logic or our process with them, but to get some real participation in the breadth of issues that we may be looking at.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments? Yes, please.
A couple of questions. And since I haven't been to the meetings, actually, I was on this board as an alternate years ago, and I was kind of shocked when I came back on, and it was like deja vu to me because this HCP is still there. So the way I understand this is that you'll, if we contract with H.T. Harvey, they'll prepare the HCP for submittal to, you said, federal resource agencies. Then they'll approve it, and then from there, it's up to the to us to, or to, I shouldn't say us, but to you to implement the plan?
Yeah, at the point, well, first off, we would submit the documents. H.T. Harvey has tasks and money to be under contract in the post-submittal process, so the agencies come back for clarification or minor changes or that sort of thing. But once it goes through this agency approval process, and H.T. Harvey assists with preparing what's called an implementation agreement, which is a legal agreement between the district and those agencies as to essentially what's going to happen and what's not going to happen and all the details of implementing the HCP. There'll be a monitoring requirement, so there'll be regular reporting on where we are and what's going on. But it would be the district via Zone 3 implementing the activities. First off, of course, the downstream release program, and we already keep detailed records on those. We would develop a format for recording and reporting those to the agencies, of course, a public document. And then if there are financial contributions, you know, I can foresee an annual report like a budget showing what's going on and what the plans are for and the amount of creek that's excavated to be able to stabilize it to handle the potential flows over the spillway are quite impressive. Now, that's an easy one to commit to maintaining because it protects our pipe.
Yeah.
So we have an interest, a secondary interest, in our perspective, maybe a primary interest in keeping that part of the creek entirely stable. There's a similar thing with the gauge. We have a stream record back to 1940 from that gauge. We have a very strong interest in maintaining that consistent record. So whatever modifications are made for fish passage need to be holding the stream constant so that it doesn't throw off our calculations and that long stream scientific record.
Yeah. So this plan itself will... Once it's prepared and submitted, it's done, it's over? Or is it a working document that just keeps going forever?
It's typically a working document. There's a, I can't remember the name of the process, but you notice there's a monitoring account. So we'd be tracking fish populations with that account, water quality issues, what's happening in the stream. And adaptive management is the term. So there's opportunity for adjustments and changes to be made as we go along.
Okay. Thank you.
Deja vu.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
I think there's a the point of the once it's submitted, though, it's not that it's going to go through the federal process. I feel like Shannon mentioned that the agencies are going to have
to. Oh, yeah. Well, we should point out that the approval process involves, there's significant public involvement there. So the submitted document goes out. There'll be hearings. There'll be opportunity for other groups to comment. And there'll be significant back and forth between us and the agencies in responding to other groups' comments.
Okay.
Thank you.
Then that leads to my question. Do we have a good time frame? I mean, I've seen in the documents here, if we contract with H.D. Harvey, they're talking about 18 months to have this HCP ready. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then what's the time frame after that? And then do we have anything in place that will make sure that H.D. Harvey stays within that time frame or some kind of incentive to get it done earlier?
We actually extended H.D. Harvey's time frame because of the water availability analysis. There are parts of the document that we can jump into now with both feet and bring up to current standards. There's information gaps we can fill. But there's other parts of the document that if the water availability analysis were to cause changes in the downstream release program, then we would be ahead of ourselves and we would have to come back and redo work. So I've taken their schedule and stretched it out in the middle, moved two major tasks backing up from 18 months. All of that trying to estimate how long it's going to take a water availability analysis to produce information. We'll have to look at the information and get an understanding of our confidence level and make decisions about whether we turn H.D. Harvey loose or whether we hold them back. So I think an 18-month schedule at this point is my estimation of water availability analysis and seeing Stetson Engineers work. You know, we have the variables of the State Water Resources Control Board, how long they're going to be in and out of things. So that's one of those things we have to track very carefully as we're moving on different paths, is that the coordination, timing, nobody gets ahead of anybody. Now, the post-submittal schedule also shows 18 months from when we get the document to them and they accept it as an appropriate and complete document. I scheduled a discussion with your board or with your committee about the post-submittal process. I don't want to stand up here and say that I'm dubious about that schedule, but I want to make sure that we all understand that schedule versus the experience of some other agencies. And again, I think at that discussion we may have some suggestions for preparing for various strategies to help the agencies come closer to 18 months rather than longer.
Can you just explain the monitoring process of the HCP? So once it's in place and the different aspects of it, who is it going to be? Someone who's in charge of that? Or what?
Well, again, the HCP in its current form establishes a monitoring account, but is very nonspecific about exactly what it is we'd be monitoring and how. We can anticipate that there's a reporting component. So we'll be documenting everything we did and how much water we released.
But whose responsibility is that?
That would be the district's.
Okay, that's what I want to make sure. Okay.
And hence the anticipation of some kind of an account. I think in the HCP it's more of a, I would anticipate, more of a commitment to properly fund monitoring and reporting efforts.
Okay.
Thank you.
Except the question about the boundary. You know, you originally talked about it ended at one point, and now we're talking about perhaps it goes all the way to the ocean. When is that going to be addressed?
I think if we get H.D. Harvey on board and can get their expertise in the implications and exactly what is it that we're committing ourselves to, and then compare that to agency expectations and the benefits, perhaps, of having take coverage farther downstream than we might otherwise have. I think we need the expertise to look at that and really bring that kind of an issue to if there's a subcommittee of the TAC or the TAC itself and have some good debate about the pros and cons so that we can come to your advisory committee and be very what's the word, very detailed about where that issue stands, what are the implications, and not necessarily just what are the implications for the project and for Zone 3, but since we have all the other agencies involved, you know, would it affect the plans and the goals of other efforts if we were to do that, either positively or negatively? What exactly would we be responsible to do, if anything? Mm-hmm. What would we be responsible to provide information on? You know, if we went to the ocean and we wanted to have coverage for the take of Tidewater Gobi, first we'd want to understand, well, how is it that we would take or impact Tidewater Gobi with what we're doing? We want to have that analysis. We want to look at that and fully understand that. Would the agencies accept the extremely detailed information and surveys that State Parks has been doing since 2004? Are they going to want us to somehow redo some expensive study? And then, you know, long term, what does it mean to have a permit and this species in your permit area? Is there some sort of mitigation or habitat enhancement specifically for Tidewater Gobies that we would have to do, and what would be the cost?
Okay, thanks.
Okay. I think I had someone ready to make a motion.
I move that we recommend to the Board of Supervisors a continuation of the HCP efforts. And I can combine that with the second with item B, or keep it separate, up to you.
Yeah, combine it. I'll second it that way.
Okay, and expand my motion to include an endorsement or recommendation to endorse the attached draft contract. Or maybe the motion is that we endorse the draft contract with H.D. Harvey and Associates.
Second that.
A motion, a second, discussion? Seeing none, can we have a vote, please?
Member Molnar?
Yes.
Member Gehring?
Yes.
Member Vardis?
Yes.
Member Lucy?
Yes.
Member Akita?
Yes.
Chairman Costello?
Yes. Motion passes. Thank you. Are we going to need to take a break here before we conclude the meeting? Let's continue. Just go on without a break. Then. Any future agenda items?
That'd be any members have any that they'd like to propose for the next meeting?
I don't see any on this side of the microphone, but
The only one that we had thought of was the idea of discussing the nature of the water rights permit and the issue of direct diversion versus diversion to storage. What were the guidelines in the 1960s versus what are they now, and getting into why is it that the permit needs to be revised in order to get approved, and the status of those efforts with the State Water Board.
That could be a great discussion topic.
Okay. Look forward to that. Do any members have any other items they'd like on a future agenda? Seeing none, we'll move along. Committee member comments. Does anyone have any comments they need to bring forward at this point? Okay. Well, then at that point, I guess we will
next meeting.
Adjourn the meeting, and we will next regular scheduled meeting tentatively scheduled for Thursday, March 15th, 6:30 p.m. in the Arroyo Grande City Council chambers. We are adjourned. We'll see you then.